thought, should die on his hands and knees. As quick as he could, the old man climbed over the bench, mounted Deems, who was on all fours, and with the gun still in one fist, did the Heimlich maneuver on him.
"I learnt this from a young pup in South Carolina," he grunted proudly. "A white fella. He growed up to be a doctor."
The overall effect, seen from across the square, the nearby street, and every window that faced the plaza, 350 in all, was not good. From a distance, it looked like the vicious drug lord Deems Clemens was on all fours, being humped like a dog from the back by an old man, sport coat of all people, jouncing atop Deems in his old sports jacket and pork pie hat.
"He fucked him hard," Miss Izzy said later, when describing the incident to the fascinated members of the Puerto Rican Statehood Society of the Cause Houses. The society was only two other people, Eleonora Soto and Angela Negron. But they enjoyed the story immensely, especially the part about Deems spitting up the leftover sandwich, which looked, Miss Izzy said, like the two tiny white testicles of her ex-husband Joaquin, after she poured warm olive oil on them when she found him snoring in the arms of her cousin Emilia, who was visiting from Aguadilla. The humping didn't last long. Deems had lookouts everywhere, including from the rooftops of four buildings that looked down on the plaza, and they scrambled into action. The lookouts from the roofs of buildings 9 and 34 bolted for the stairs, while two of Deems' dope slingers, who had scurried away after the initial blast, got their wits back and stepped towards Sportcoat. Even though he was still drunk, Sportcoat saw them coming. He released Deems and quickly swung the big barrel of the .45 caliber toward them. The two boys fled again, this time for good, disappearing into the basement of nearby Building 34. Sportcoat watched them run, suddenly confused again. With the gun still in his hand, he turned toward Jet, who was 10 feet off, standing erect and frozen now, one hand on his broom. Jet, terrified, stared at the old man who squinted back at him in the afternoon sun, which had come up high now. Their eyes locked, and at that moment Jet felt as if he were looking into the ocean. The old man's gaze was deep-set, detached, calm, and Jet suddenly felt as if he were floating in a spot of placid sea, while giant waves roiled and swelled and lifted up the waters all around him. He had a sudden revelation. "We're the same," Jet thought. "We're trapped."
"I got the cheese," the old deacon said calmly as the moans of Deems wafted behind him. "Understand? I got the cheese."
"You got the cheese," Jet said. But the old man didn't hear. He had already turned on his heel, pocketed the gun, and limped quickly toward his building 100 yards off. But instead of heading to the entrance, he veered off, teetering down the side ramp that led to the basement boiler room. Jet, frozen with fear, watched him go. Then out of the corner of his eye, he saw the lights of a police cruiser fly by the street edge of the pedestrian plaza, a distance of about a city block. The car skidded to a stop, backed up, then plunged straight down the pedestrian walkway toward him. Relief washed over him as the squad car fought its way through the fleeing pedestrians, causing the driver to brake, swivel left, then right to avoid the panicked bystanders. Behind that car, Jet saw two more cruisers swing onto the walkway and follow. His relief was so enormous, he felt like he'd just taken a great relieving piss, one that had drained him of every bit of life force. He turned one last time to see the old man's head disappearing down the basement ramp of Building 9, then felt his guts unlock and found himself able to act. He dropped his broom and leaped over the bench toward Clemens, just as he heard the tires of a squad car slide to a stop behind him.
As he crouched over Clemens, he heard an officer shouting at him to freeze, stand up, and put up his hands. As Jet did, he said to himself, "I'm no longer doing this. I am finished." "Don't move! Don't turn around!" Two hands grabbed him from behind and pinned his arms. His face was slammed against the squad car hood. He felt cuffs slapped onto his wrists. From his view, with his ear flush against the hot hood of the car, he could see the plaza, busy as a train station minutes before, completely deserted. A few flyers fluttering in the wind, and the thick white hand of the cop on the car hood near his face. The cop had put his hand there to brace his weight on it, while the other hand pinned Jet's head into place. Jet stared at the hand a foot from his eyeballs and noticed a wedding ring on it. "I know that hand," he thought. When his head was snatched from the hood, Jet found himself staring at his old partner, Potts. Deems was on the ground, 20 feet off, and surrounded by cops. "I didn't do nothing," Jet shouted, loud enough for Clemens and anyone nearby to hear. Potts spun him around, then patted him down, carefully avoiding the .38 caliber strapped to his ankle. As he did, Jet muttered, "Arrest me, Potts, for God's sake." Potts grabbed him by the collar and swung him toward the back seat of his squad car. "You're an idiot," he murmured softly. Chapter 4. Running Off. Sportcoat walked into the basement furnace room of Building 9 and sat on a fold-out chair next to the giant coal furnace in a huff. He heard the wail of a siren, then forgot all about it. He didn't care about any siren. He was looking for something. His eyes scanned the floor, then stopped, as he suddenly remembered he was supposed to memorize a Bible verse for his upcoming Friends and Family Day sermon. It was about righting wrongs. Was it the book of Romans or Micah? He couldn't recall. Then his mind slid to the same old nagging problem: Hetty and the Christmas Club money. "We got along all right till you decide to fool with that damn Christmas Club," he snorted. He looked around the basement for Hetty. She didn't appear. "You hear me?" "Nothing." "Well, that's all right, too," he snapped. "The church ain't holding no notes on me about that missing money. It's you who got to live with it, not me." He stood and began to search for a bottle of emergency King Kong that Sausage always kept hidden someplace, but was still pie-eyed and feeling addled and murky. He pushed around the discarded tools and bicycle parts on the floor with his foot, muttering, "Some people got to stay mad to keep from getting mad," he grumbled. "Some goes from preaching to meddling and meddling to preaching and can't hardly tell the difference." "Well, it ain't my money, Hetty. It's the church's money." He stopped moving items with his foot for a moment and stilled, talking to the air. "It's all the same," he announced. "You got to have a principle or you ain't nothing. What you think of that?" Silence. "I thought so." Calmer now, he started searching again, bending down and talking as he checked toolboxes and under bricks. "You never did think of my money, did you? Like with that old mule I had down home," he said. "The one old Mr. Tullis wanted to buy, he offered me $100 for her. I said, 'Mr. Tullis, it'll take a smooth $200 to move her. Old man wouldn't pay that much. Remember? That mule up and died 2 weeks later. I could have sold her. You should have told me to turn her loose.'" Silence. "Well, Hetty, if I weren't taking that white man's good $100 on principle, I surely ain't going to take no mess from you about some $14.09 you done squirreled up in Christmas Club money and hid someplace." He paused, looked out the corner of his eye, then said softly,
It is $14, ain't it? It ain't, say, $200 or $300, is it? I can't do $300. $14 is sheep money. I can raise that sleeping. But $300, that's over my head, honey.
He stopped moving, frustrated, still looking around, unable to find what he was looking for.
That money, it ain't mine, Hetty.
There was still no answer, and he sat down again in the folding chair, flummoxed. Sitting in the cold seat, he had an unfamiliar, odd, nagging feeling that something terrible had occurred. The feeling wasn't unusual for him, especially since Hetty died. Normally he ignored it, but this time it felt bigger than usual. He couldn't place it, then suddenly spied the prize he was looking for, and forgot about the problem instantly. He stood up, shuffled over to a hot water heater, reached under it, and pulled out the bottle of Rufus's homemade King Kong. He held the bottle up to the bare ceiling light bulb.
I say a drink. I say a glass. I say, do you know me? I say, the note is due. I say, bring the hands. I say, a poke and a choke, Hetty. I say, God only knows when. Brace.
Sportcoat turned up the bottle, drank a deep swallow, and the nagging feeling bubbled away. He placed the bottle back in its hiding place and relaxed in his seat, satisfied.
Gwong, King Kong,
he murmured. Then he wondered aloud.
What day is this, Hetty?
He realized she wasn't speaking to him. So he said,
Hell, I don't need you. I can read.
Which was actually not true. He could read a calendar. Words were another matter. He rose, ambled over to a weathered wall calendar, peered at it through the haze of his drunken glow, then nodded. It was Thursday. Itkin's Day. He had four jobs, one for every day but Sunday. Mondays, he cleaned Five Ends Church. Tuesdays, he emptied the garbage at the nursing home. Wednesdays, he helped an old white lady with the garden of her brownstone. Thursdays, he unloaded crates at Itkin's liquor store, just four blocks from the Cause houses. Fridays and Saturdays had once been baseball practice for the Cause House's baseball team before it disbanded. Sportcoat looked over at the wall clock. Almost 1 o'clock. He had to get to work.
Gotta go, Hetty, he said cheerily.
He pulled out the bottle again and took another quick nip of the Kong, slid it back to its hiding place, and walked out the back door of the basement, which exited a block away from the plaza flagpole. The street was clear and quiet. He wobbled easily, freely, the fresh air steadying him a bit and partially lifting the drunken haze. Within moments, he was heading down the row of neat shops that lined Pacelli Street and the nearby Italian neighborhood. He loved walking to Mr. Itkin's place, toward downtown Brooklyn, seeing the neat row homes and storefronts, the stores full of shopkeepers, some of whom waved at him as he walked past. Stacking booze and helping customers cart their wine to their cars was one of his favorite small jobs. Small jobs that didn't last more than a day and didn't require tools were perfect for him. 10 minutes later, he ambled to a door under an awning that read, Itkin's Liquors. As he reached it, a police car roared past. Then another. He paused at the door, hastily felt in his jacket vest pocket, where he stored booze or any empty or stray liquor bottles that might have been stuffed in there from some previous unremembered moment of elbow bending, forgetting his hip pockets altogether, then turned the door handle. The doorbell jingled as he entered and closed it behind him, shutting off the howl of yet another police car and ambulance roaring past. Mr. Itkin, the owner, a stout, easygoing Jew, was wiping the countertop, his paunch protruding over the edge. The store was silent. The air conditioning was blasting. It was still 5 minutes till opening time. Itkin nodded over Sportcoat's shoulder at the cop cars racing toward the cause houses.
"What's going on out there?"
"Diabetes,"
Sportcoat said, plodding past Itkin's counter to the back stockroom.
"Killing them off one by one."
He slipped into the back room, where stacks of newly arrived liquor boxes awaited opening. He sat down on a crate with a sigh. He didn't care about any sirens. He removed his hat and wiped his brow. The counter where Itkin stood was a good 20 feet from the door to the back room. But Itkin, from his vantage point at the edge of the counter, could see Sportcoat clearly. He stopped wiping and called out,
"You look a little peaked, Deacon."
Sportcoat dismissed the concern with a grin and an easy yawn, stretching his arms wide.
"I'm feeling dandy and handy," he said.
Itkin returned to wiping his counter, moving out of sight to work the other side of it, while Sportcoat, carefully keeping out of Itkin's sightline, grabbed a root beer from a crate, cracked it open, took a long drink of it, put it down on a nearby shelf, and began stacking boxes. He glanced to make sure Itkin was still at the far end of the counter and out of view. Then, with the practiced smoothness of a cat burglar, he snatched a bottle of gin out of a nearby case, unscrewed its cap, and poured half its contents into the root beer can, closed the bottle, stuffed it into his jacket hip pocket, removed the jacket, and placed it on a nearby shelf. The coat landed with an odd clank. For a moment, Sportcoat thought he had a forgotten bottle stuffed in the pocket on the other side, since he'd only quickly rifled through his chest pockets before entering the store, and not his hip pockets. So he snatched up the coat again, fished in the hip pockets, and yanked out the old .45 caliber.
"How'd my army gun get here?"
he muttered. Just then, the jingle of the door sounded. He shoved the gun back into the jacket and glanced up to see several of the day's first customers entering, all of them white, followed by the familiar pork pie hat and brown worried face of Hot Sausage, still wearing his blue Housing Authority janitor uniform. Sausage lingered at the door a moment, feigning interest in a nearby liquor display as the paying customers fanned out. Itkin, irritated, glanced at him. Sausage blurted,
"Deacon left something at home."
Itkin nodded curtly toward the back room, where Sportcoat could be seen, then was called down an aisle by one of the customers, which allowed Sausage to slip past the counter and into the back room. Sportcoat noticed he was sweating and breathing hard.
"Sausage, what you want?"
he said.
"Itkin don't like you back here."
Hot Sausage glanced over his shoulder, then hissed,
"Goddamn fool. What you so hot about? You gotta run, now." "What you fussing at me for?"
Sportcoat said. He offered the root beer can.
"Have a sip shot for your cold top."
Sausage snatched the root beer soda can, sniffed it, then slammed it down on a crate so hard, liquid popped out the opening.
"Nigga, you ain't got time to sit around sipping essence. You gotta put your foot on the road."
"What?"
"You gotta go."
"Go where? I just got here."
"Go anyplace, fool. Run off."
"I ain't leaving my job, Sausage."
"Clemens ain't dead,"
Sausage said.
"Who?"
Sportcoat asked.
"Dames. He ain't dead."
"Who?"
Hot Sausage stepped back, blinking.
"What's the matter with you, Sport?"
Sportcoat sat down on a crate, wearily shaking his head.
"Don't know, Sausage. I've been talking to Hetty about my sermons for Friends and Family Day. She got to hollering about that cheese again and the Christmas Club money. Then she throwed in my mama. She said my mama didn't..."
"Cut that mumbo-jumbo, Sport. You in trouble."
"With Hetty?" What I done now?
Hetty's been dead 2 years, fool. Sportcoat puckered his face and said softly,
You ain't got to speak left-handed about my dear Hetty Sausage. She never done you no wrong.
She wasn't so dear last week when you was bellowing like a calf about that Christmas club money. Forget her a minute, sport. Deems ain't dead.
Who?
Deems, fool. Lewis's grandson. Remember Lewis Clemens?
Lewis Clemens?
Sportcoat tilted his head sideways, looking genuinely surprised.
Lewis been dead, Sausage. He been dead 5 years this May. He been dead longer than my Hetty.
I ain't talking about him. I'm talking about his grandson, Deems.
Sportcoat brightened.
Deems Clemens. Greatest ball player this project's ever seen, Sausage. He's gonna be the next Bullet Rogan. I seen Rogan play once back in 42 in Pittsburgh just before I come up here. Hell of a ball player. He got to arguing with the umpire and he got thrown out the game. Bob Motley was umping. Motley was something. Greatest Negro umpire ever. Jumped like a basketball player, Motley did.
Hot Sausage stared at him a moment, then said softly,
What's the matter with you, sport?
Nothing.
Hetty's just been a bear. She come to me and said, I know your mama.
Listen to me. You shot Deems, and he ain't dead. And he's gonna come at you with his hooligans, so you gotta get moving.
But Sportcoat was still talking and didn't hear him.
Degraded you. My mama did not degrade me. That was not my mama, Hetty.
He said to no one in particular,
That was my stepmama.
Hot Sausage whistled softly and sat down on another crate across from Sportcoat. He looked out into the store at Mr. Itkin, who was still busy with customers. Then he picked up the root beer can full of gin and took a long swallow.
Maybe I can get a visitor's pass, he said.
For what?
For when they put you in the penitentiary. If you live that long.
Quit chunking at me about nothing.
Hot Sausage sat thoughtfully for a moment, sipped the gin, then tried one more time.
You know Deems, right? Lewis's grandson.
Surely, Sportcoat said. Coached him in baseball, taught him in Sunday school. That boy got talent. He's shot. Near dead.
Sportcoat's brow furrowed.
Gosh almighty, he said. That's terrible.
He's shot on account of you. Hand before God, you shot him.
Sportcoat chortled for a moment, thinking it was a joke. But Hot Sausage's serious face didn't waver, and Sportcoat's smile thinned.
You funnin', right? He said. I wish I was.
You rolled up on him and throwed that old cannon of yours on him. The old one your cousin from the army gave you.
Sportcoat turned and reached into the pocket of his sports jacket lying on the shelf behind him and pulled out the Luger.
I wonder why I got this damn thing.
He hammered it against his hand to check.
See? It ain't been fired since I bought it. Ain't got but one bullet in it. And that's just for show.
Then he noticed the empty cartridge, and a pasty look crossed his face as he held the gun in front of him, staring at it. Hot Sausage pushed the gun barrel toward the floor, glancing at the door.
Put that goddamn thing away, he hissed, his voice low. You already done caused a world of trouble with it.
For the first time, seeping through Sportcoat's drunken stupor, the words began to have an effect. Sportcoat blinked in confusion, then laughed and snorted.
I disremember a lot of what I do these days, Sausage. After you and me got pixelated on the Kong last night, I went home and had a dream about Hetty and we got to fussing as usual.
Then I woke up needing a breakfast of champions, as they say, so I had a taste of the Kong to keep the crease down, you know? Then I went to see Deems about getting a baseball game against Watch Houses going again. We can't win without Deems, you know. That boy got talent. Could throw 78 miles per hour when he was 13. He smiled. I always favored him. Well, you picked a poor way of showing it. You walked to the plaza and throwed that gun on him, right in front of his gang of heathens. Sport Coat looked stunned. His brow crinkled in disbelief. But I hardly carry this thing, Sausage. I don't know how I... He wet his lips. I was drunk, I reckon. I didn't hurt him bad, did I? He ain't dead. They say just his ears shot off. That don't sound like me. It ain't smart to shoot a man's ear off. A man ain't got but two. Hot Sausage couldn't help himself. He stifled a chortle. You been home today? Nah. I come straight to work after I... Then Sport Coat paused a moment, his face etched with remembrance and concern. Well, now that I think on it, I do remember some boy with his head bleeding and choking for some reason. I remembers that. So I gived him that thing I seen a doctor do back home once. He was having trouble drawing air, poor fella, but I cleared him. I reckon that was Deems I cleared. He all right now? He's well enough to pin a gold star on your chest before airing you out. Can't be. You done it. I disremember it. It couldn't have been me. You shot that boy, Sport. Understand? Sausage. I reckon that running lie is a good one to truck about, being that a boy with that kind of talent that don't use it ought to be shot in this world for wasting it. But, hand before God, I didn't shoot him to my recollection. Even if I did, it's only because I wanted him to go back to pitching baseball. He'll forget all about it when his ear heals. I got only one good ear myself. A man can still pitch with one ear. He paused a moment, then added, anybody seen it? No. Just everybody at the flagpole. Gee, Sport Coat said softly. That's like being on TV. He took a swig of gin and felt better. He was having trouble deciding whether this was a dream. Hot Sausage picked up Sport Coat's jacket and held it out for him. Get down the road right now while you can, he said. Maybe I should call the police and explain it to him. Forget them, Sausage glanced at the door. You still got people in South Carolina? I ain't been to my home country since my daddy died. Go see Rufus over at the watch houses. Lay low over there. Maybe it'll blow over somehow. But I wouldn't buy no sweepstakes tickets on it. I ain't going over to no Rufus's place and no watch houses to sleep, Sport Coat snorted. That Negro ain't showered in 2 years. His body is dying of thirst. I got to be dead drunk to be around him. Plus, I got my own house. Not no more. Where's Pudgy gonna go? I got to take him to the school bus in the morning. The church'll see to that, Hot Sausage said, still holding out Sport Coat's jacket. Sport Coat snatched the jacket from Sausage's hand and placed it back on the liquor rack, grumbling, You lying! I didn't shoot Deems. I woke up this morning fussing with Hetty. I walked Pudgy to the blind folks' school bus. I maybe had a taste or three. Then I come here. Sometime in the middle there, I had another swig of the erratic and took Deem's ear off. Maybe I done it. Maybe not. So what? He got another ear? What's an ear when you got an arm like Deem's? I know the man back home who got his pecker cut off by a white man for stealing a lady's purse. He peed through a groin hole his whole life. He did all right. He's yet living, far as I know. The white man or the man without a pecker? They both yet living to my knowing, and they got to know each other good over time. So why you all hot and bothered about somebody's old ear for? Even Jesus didn't need but one sandal. The book of Psalms says you ain't desired my ears, and you ain't opened them either.
He says, what now?
Something like that. What difference do it make? God'll straighten it out. He'll make Deems one better than two ears. That business decided, Sportcoat began unpacking liquor bottles from a crate. You want to go fishing this weekend? He said. I'm getting paid tomorrow. I needs to reflect on my first ever sermon at Five Ends. It's in 3 weeks. It was about the hereafter. You ain't gonna be short on critters and believers, that's for sure. If I was a fly and wanted to get to heaven, I'd throw myself in your mouth. It ain't about no fly. It's about not eating the dressing without confessing. Book of Romans, 14th chapter, 10th verse. Or maybe it's Simon, 7th and 9th. It's one or the other. I got to look. Hot Sausage stared, incredulous, as Sportcoat continued unloading liquor bottles.
Nigga, your cheese done slid off your cracker.
Just 'cause you says I got a note due someplace don't mean I got one.
Is you listening, Sport? You dropped Deems in his tracks, then humped him like a dog in front of everybody.
You ought to test your lies someplace else other than your best friend, Sausage. I never humped a man in my life.
You was drunk. I don't swallow any more spirits than anybody else in these projects.
Now who's lying? I ain't the one they calling Deacon King Kong.
I don't get in a knot over the fibbing and twiddling things folks say about me, Sausage. I got my own thoughts about things.
Hot Sausage glanced out the door. Itkin's customers had left, and the store owner was peering into the back room where they were standing. Sausage reached into his pocket and pulled out a small clump of dollar bills. He held the crumpled bills out to Sportcoat, who had paused and was now standing before him, glaring, his arms full of liquor bottles.
$31. It's all I got, Sport. Take it and get a bus ticket home. I ain't going no place.
Hot Sausage sighed sadly, pocketed the money, and turned to leave.
All right. I guess I'll use it to buy a bus ticket to see you in the penitentiary upstate, if you live that long.
Chapter 5. The Governor. Thomas Elefante, the elephant, heard about the Deems Clemens shooting an hour after it happened. He was working on his mother's flower bed in his brownstone on Silver Street, just 3 blocks from the Cause houses, dreaming of meeting a plump, good-looking farm girl when a uniformed cop from the 76th Precinct rolled up, called him over to his squad car, and relayed the news. "They got a line on the shooter," the cop said. Elefante leaned on the squad car door and listened in silence while the cop blabbed on about what the cops knew. They knew the victim. They were certain about the shooter, too. Elefante didn't care about any shooter. That was Joe Peck's problem. If the coloreds wanted to kill each other over Peck's dope, that was Joe's headache, not his. Except, of course, killings brought cops like this one. Cops wrecked the economy. His economy, anyway. Moving hot goods while cops were running an investigation in your backyard was like being the dumbest kid in class who always raises his hand anyway. No matter how stupid you are, it's only a matter of time before the teacher calls on you. Elefante was 40, heavyset and handsome. His dark eyes and gaunt jaw held a stony silence that cloaked a delightful, sarcastic sense of humor despite a childhood of bittersweet disappointment. His father had spent a good part of Elefante's childhood in jail. His opinionated, eccentric mother, who ran his father's dock at the harbor during his dad's imprisonment, spent her spare time collecting plants from every empty lot within 5 miles of the cause, a hobby to which she increasingly dragged her reluctant bachelor son, who, she often noted, had worked himself well past the marrying age. Elefante ignored those comments, though lately he'd conceded to himself she was probably right. All the good Italian women in the Causeway neighborhood were already married or had fled to the suburbs with their families now that the Coloreds were fully established. The time to get married, he thought, was when I was young and stupid, like this cop. Even this lumphead, he thought bitterly, was probably dating some hot young number. He could tell by the way the kid talked he wasn't from Brooklyn. He likely wasn't even from the Cause District. He looked barely 21, and Elefante, staring at him, guessed the guy was clocking maybe $7,000 a year. And still he's meeting women, Elefante thought. Me, I'm just a kickball, a blob. I might as well be a gardener. He listened with half an ear as the kid chatted, then stepped back and leaned on the fender of the parked car behind him to glance up and down the street while the cop yammered on. The kid was careless and obviously inexperienced. He double-parked right in front of Elefante's house, in full view of every house on the block, which, like everything else around here, the elephant thought, ruefully, wasn't safe. It wasn't like the old days when everybody was Italian. The new neighbors were Russian, Jewish, Spanish, even colored. Anything but Italian. He let the cop blab a little more, then, interrupting him, said, "The cause ain't my business." The cop seemed surprised. "You ain't got interest down there?" he said, pointing out the windshield of his patrol car toward the cause houses, which rose like a pyramid 3 blocks distant, glimmering in the hot afternoon sun that sent heat waves off the beaten streets, and the Statue of Liberty, which could be seen shimmering at a distance in the harbor. "Interests," Elefante said. "They used to have baseball games down there. I liked those." The cop looked disappointed, and a little afraid. And for the briefest of moments, Elefante felt sorry for him. It bothered him that people, even cops, feared him. But it was the only way. He had done a few terrible things over the years, but only to defend his interests. Of course, he'd done some nice things too, but got no credit for any of them. It was how the world worked. Anyway, this stupid kid seemed okay, so Elefante pulled a 20 out of his pocket, carefully folded it in his fingers in his left hand, leaned into the car window, and deftly let it slip to the floor of the patrol car before turning away and stepping back onto the sidewalk. "See ya, kid." The kid drove off fast. Elefante didn't bother watching his taillights disappear. Instead, he looked in the other direction. It was an old habit. If one cop goes this way, look for the second coming that way. When he was satisfied the street was clear, he stepped to his wrought iron gate, opened it, and re-entered the garden that fronted his modest brownstone, closing it carefully behind him. Still wearing his suit, he dropped to his knees and began digging at the plants, glumly, considering the shooting. Drugs, he fumed silently as he dug. Fucking drugs. He stopped digging to peer over his mother's flower garden. He scanned the different ones. He knew them all. Sunflower, catchfly, Jerusalem oak, bedfly, hawthorn, witch hazel, cinnamon fern, and what was the last? This one he was replanting right there? Lady fern, maybe? The ferns were not doing well. Neither were the hazels and hawthorn. He bent over and began digging. "I'm the only 40-year-old bachelor in New York," he thought ruefully, "whose mother collects flowers like junk, and then expects me to replant whatever crap she finds." But the fact is, he didn't mind. The work relaxed him, and the garden was her pride and joy.
She picked most of the plants out of the abandoned railroad tracks, ditches, and weeds that sprouted around the deserted lots and factories of the Cause District. Some, like this fern, were real treasures, arriving as near weeds and blossoming into full-grown plants. He scratched away at the fern, digging it out, pulling fresh earth out of a nearby wheelbarrow, pushing more earth aside, setting the new earth in place, and re-anchoring the fern gently into place with the smooth efficiency born of experience and repetition. He stared at his work a moment before moving on to replant the next. Normally, his mother would check his work later on, but lately, she'd been too sick to get out, and the garden was beginning to show small signs of neglect. Several plants were brown and dying. Others needed replanting. Several she wanted brought inside and potted. "There's something going around Brooklyn," she declared. "Some kind of disease." The elephant agreed, but not the kind of disease she was worried about. "Greed," he thought wryly as he dug into the earth. "That's the disease. I got it myself." 2 weeks before, in the dead of night, an elderly Irishman had wandered into his boxcar at the pier while he and his men were loading cigarettes onto a truck. Nighttime visitors and odd characters were not unusual given his line of work, which included moving hot goods off harbor boats, storing them, or moving them inland to wherever the customer wanted. But this visitor was odd even by his standards. He looked to be about 70. He was clad in a tattered jacket and bow tie with a full head of white hair. His face had so many lines and rivulets it reminded Elefante of an old subway map. One eye was swollen shut, apparently permanently. He was thin and sickly, and seemed to have trouble breathing. When he entered, Elefante motioned for him to sit. The visitor complied, thankfully.
"I wonder if you could help a man in need," the old man said. His Irish brogue was so thick, Elefante had trouble understanding him.
Despite his physical frailness, his voice was clear, and he spoke with an air of solidity and bearing, as if walking into the boxcar of one of Brooklyn's most unpredictable smugglers at 3 a.m. was as simple as walking into a bodega and ordering a pound of bologna.
"Depends on the need," Elefante said.
"Salvi Doyle sent me," the old fellow said. "He said you could help me out."
"Don't know a Salvi Doyle."
The old Irishman smirked and tugged at his bow tie.
"He said you could move things."
Elefante shrugged.
"I'm just a poor Italian who runs a trucking and storage company, mister. And we're running late."
"Construction?"
"A little construction. A little storage, some moving. Nothing heavy. Mostly I move peanuts and cigarettes."
Elefante nodded at several nearby crates labeled cigarettes.
"You want a cigarette?"
"Nah. Bad for my throat. I'm a singer."
"What kind of singing?"
"The best kind," the old man said gaily.
Elefante stifled a smile. He couldn't help himself. The old bugger barely seemed capable of drawing air.
"Sing me a song, then," he said.
He said it for amusement and was surprised when the old man moved his head from side to side to stretch his neck muscles, cleared his throat, stood up, thrust his whiskered chin toward the ceiling, spread his thin arms, and burst into a gorgeous, clear tenor that filled the room with glorious lilting song. "I remember the day 'twas wild and drear, a night to the Hudson waves. Our parson bore a corpse on a bier to lie in the convict's grave. Venus lay covered and taut. She was the beauty of Willendorf. She rests at the bottom of a shallow grave." He broke off in a fit of coughing.
"Okay, okay," Elefante said, before he could continue.
Two of the elephant's men,
who were trooping in a steady line hauling crates back and forth through the boxcar to a waiting box truck, paused to smile.
"I ain't finished yet," the old man said.
"That's good enough," Elefanti said. "Don't you know any Italian songs? Like a trialero?"
"If I said I knew what that was, I'd be courting you."
"It's a song from northern Italy. Only men sing it."
"Get your own bulldogs to sing that one, mister." "Oh, I got something better," the Irishman said. He coughed again, a racking one this time, then regained himself and cleared his throat.
"I take it you're in need of money."
"I look that bad?"
"I have a small shipment that needs to go to Kennedy Airport," he said.
Elefanti glanced at the two men who had stalled to watch. They quickly scurried back to work. This was business. Elefanti motioned for the Irishman to sit in the chair next to his desk, out of the way of foot traffic.
"I don't haul stuff to the airport," Elefanti said. "I do storage and light hauling, mostly for grocery stores."
"Save that for the government," the Irishman said. "Salvi Doyle told me you could be trusted."
Elefanti was silent for a moment, then said,
"Salvi,
last I heard was pushing up worms in Staten Island someplace."
The Irishman chuckled.
"Not when he knew me. Or your father. We were friends."
"My father didn't have friends. Back when we was guests of the state, your father had many friends. May God bless him in his eternal resting place."
"If you want a wailing wall, use the desktop," Elefanti said. "Get the show on the road."
"What?"
"What's your point, mister?" Elefanti said impatiently. "What do you want?"
"I already said it. I need something. Move to Kennedy."
"And past Kennedy?"
"That's my business."
"Is it a big shipment?"
"No, but it needs a trusted ride."
"Get a cab."
"Don't trust a cab."
"I trusted Salvi, who said you could be trusted."
"How did Salvi hear of me?"
"He knew your father. I told you."
"Nobody knew my father."
"It was hard to know."
The Irishman chuckled.
"You're right. I don't think he said more than 3 words a day."
That was true. Elefanti filed the fact that the Irishman knew this away for posterity.
"So who do you work for?" he asked.
"Myself,"
the Irishman said.
"What's that mean?"
"It means I don't need a doctor's note when I call in sick,"
the Irishman said.
Elefanti snorted and stood up. "I'll have one of my guys run you to the subway. It's dangerous around here at night. The junkies and the cars will stick a pistol in your face for a quarter."
"Wait, friend," the old man said. "I've known you 2 minutes, and I'm tired of the friendship already, mister. The name's Driscoll Sturgis. I run a bagel shop in the Bronx."
"You ought to run a lion service. An Irishman running a bagel shop."
"It's legal."
"You better head back to whatever packing crate you call home, mister. My pop had no Irish friends. The only Irish my father talked to were cops, and they were like a fungus. You want to ride to the subway or not?"
The old man's cheeriness emptied out of his face.
"Guido Elefanti knew plenty Irish in Sing Sing, sir. Lenny Belton, Peter Seamus, Salvi, myself. We were all friends. Give me a minute, will you?"
"I ain't got a minute," the elephant said.
He stood and moved to the doorway, expecting the old man to rise. Instead, Driscoll peered up at him and said,
"You got a good company here. How's the health of it?"
Elefanti snapped his glance down to the Irishman.
"Say that again," he said. "How's the health of your trucking company?"
Elefanti sat back down and frowned.
"What's your name now?"
"Sturgis.
Driscoll Sturgis."
"You got any other names?"
"Well, your father knew me as the governor. And may your health always be fine and the wind at your back. May the road rise up to meet you. And may God hold you in the palm of his hand." That's a poem, lad. I made up a ditty with the last line of it. Want to hear it?
He stood up to sing, but Elefante reached a long arm out, grabbed the old man's jacket, and tugged him back into his chair.
Sit a minute.
Elefante stared at him a long moment, feeling like his ears had just blown off his head, his mind buzzing the red alarm of an important, hazy memory. The governor. He'd heard the name before in a long, distant past. His father had mentioned it several times, but when? It had been years ago. It was near the end of his father's life, and he, Elefante, was 19 then, at an age when teenagers didn't listen.
The governor?
The governor of what? He dug deep in the recesses of his mind, trying to draw it out. The governor. It was something big. It had to do with money. But what?
The governor, you say?
Elefante said, stalling.
That's right. Your papa never mentioned me.
Elefante sat a moment, blinking, and cleared his throat.
Maybe,
he said. His father, Guido Elefante, had had a 6-word vocabulary, spoken 4 times a day. But each word was a saber that cut through the dimly lit bedroom where he'd spent the last years of his life, crippled by a stroke suffered in prison. His grim, harsh commands cutting into the heart of his once happy-go-lucky boy, who had spent most of his growing years running wild with a mother unable to control him, raised by neighbors and cousins, while Guido had spent most of Elefante's childhood doing time in jail for a crime Guido never disclosed. Elefante was 18 when his father came out of jail. The two were never close. Guido, failed by another stroke that got him for good just short of his son's 20th birthday. By then, the son had spent a good part of his young life without a father. Other than a few occasions when he was 5 and the old man took him swimming at the Cause House's pool, Elefante had few memories of leisure time with his pop. The old man who came home from jail that last time was silent as ever, a grim, suspicious, stone-faced Italian, ruling his wife and son with iron efficiency, guided by the one motto that he forced into his son's consciousness, one that had led Guido safely from the poverty-stricken docks of Genoa to his dying moments in a handsome Cause brownstone bought and paid for cash. Everything you are, everything you will be in this cruel world, depends on your word. A man who cannot keep his word, Guido said, is worthless. Only in his later years did Elefante truly appreciate his old man's power, his ability, even bedridden and debilitated, to manage his trucking, storage, and construction business with clever, assured firmness. The old man, with an odd wife, working his business in a world of two-faced mobsters with no imagination, and always willing to break his long silences with the same warnings. Keep a tight mouth. Never ask questions of customers. Remember, we're just a bunch of poor Genoans working for Sicilians who don't have our health in mind. That and health. The old man was a fanatic about health. Your health is everything. Keep your health in mind. Elefante heard that so much he grew sick of it. At first, Elefante believed that credo came from the old man's own health misfortunes. But as the old man spiraled toward death, the admonition took on new meaning. As he sat before the elderly Irishman in his boxcar, the moment of realization suddenly tumbled into Elefante's consciousness with startling efficiency, landing on his insides with a heaviness that felt like a blacksmith's hammer falling on an anvil. They were in the old man's bedroom just days before he died. The old man had sent his mother to the store, claiming he needed fresh orange juice, something he disliked but occasionally drank for his wife's sake. They were in the bedroom, just the two of them, watching Bill Butel, the longtime anchorman on Channel 7, giving the local news,
Elefante in the room's only chair. The old man propped on the bed. His pop seemed distracted. He raised his head from his pillow and said,
"Turn the TV sound up."
Elefante did as he was told, then moved his chair next to the bed. As he tried to sit, the old man reached up and grabbed his shirt and pulled him onto the bed, yanking his son's head close to his.
"Keep your eyes open for someone."
"Who?"
"An old fella. Irishman. The governor."
"The governor of New York?" Elefante asked.
"Not that crook," his father said. "The other governor. The Irish one. That's his name, the governor. If he shows, and he probably won't, he'll ask about your health. That's how you know it's him."
"What about my health?" His father ignored him.
"And he'll sing that song about the road rising up to meet you, and the wind being at your back and God being in the palm of your hand. All that Irish Catholic crap. If he's crowing that and asking about your health, that's him."
"What about him?"
"I'm holding something for him, and he's come to collect it. Give it to him. He'll treat you fair."
"What are you holding?" But then they heard the door open and his mother return. So the old man shut down, saying they'd talk later. Later never came. The old man slipped into incomprehensibility a day later and died. Elefante, seated before the Irishman, who was staring at him oddly, tried to keep his voice even.
"Papa did mention something about health, but that was a long time ago. Just before he died, I was 20, so I don't remember so well."
"Ah, but a fair playmate he was. He never forgot a friend. A better man I never knew. He looked out for me in prison."
"Look, get your blockers out of the backfield, would you?"
"What?"
"Put the show on the road, mister.
What you selling?" "I'll say it once again for Mother Mary. I need something moved to Kennedy."
"Is it too big for a car?"
"No. You can fit it in your hand." "You want to play blackjacks and spout riddles all day? What is it?" The governor smiled. "If I was lightheaded enough to drag a barrel full of trouble to a friend's house, what kind of man would I be?"
"That's touching, but it sounds like a lie."
"I'd move it myself,"
the Irishman said.
"But it's in storage."
"Get it out then."
"That's just it. I can't. The header running the storage place don't know me."
"Who's the guy?"
The old man smirked and peered at Elefante out of the side of his one good eye.
"I tell you in installments. But at my age, how's that going to work out? Why don't you wind your neck in and pay attention?"
He smiled grimly, then from his chair, sang softly. "Wars were shared and gay for each, until the Venus faced the breach. The Venus, so dear to me, at Willendorf always her image be. The Venus, O beauty, now covered and taut, lost to me, but not for naught." When he stopped, he found Elefante glaring at him, his lips pursed.
"If you want to keep your teeth," Elefante said, "don't sing no more."
The old Irishman was nonplussed. "I got no tricks," he said. "Something fell in my lap many a year ago. I need your help getting it and moving it."
"What is it?"
Again, the old man ignored the question.
"I'm on a short lease, lad. I'm on the way out. It won't do me no good. My lungs are going. I got a grown lass, a daughter. I'm giving her my bagel business. It's a good clean business."
"What's an Irishman doing, baking bagels?" "Is that illegal?" "No worries about the cops, son. Come up and see it if you want. It's a good operation. We're in the Bronx.
right off the Bruckner Expressway. You'll see I'm square.
If you're so square and tidy, give your daughter what you got and live happily ever after.
I said I don't want my daughter mixed up in it. You can have it. You can keep it or sell it. Or sell it and give me a little piece if you want. And keep the rest for yourself.
However you like. That'll be the end of it.
At least it won't be wasted.
You ought to be a wedding planner, mister. First you want me to move it. Then you want to give it to me. Then you want me to sell it and give you a piece. What is it, for Christ's sake?
The old man looked at Elefante sideways. Your old man told me a story once. He said you wanted a job working for the five families when he came out. You want to know how the story ends?
I already know how it ends. No, you don't, the governor said.
Your papa bragged on you in prison. Said you would run his business good someday. Said you could keep a secret.
Sure can. Want to hear one? My papa's dead, and he ain't paying my bills now.
What you getting hat for, son? Your papa gifted you. He put this thing up, stored it for me years ago, and you've got the key to it.
How do you know I didn't use the key and sell the thing already, whatever it is?
Elefante asked. If you'd done that, you wouldn't be making a bag of it in this blessed boxcar in the wee hours, moving this shit you call goods, which, if I'm remembering right from the old days, let's see, 12-foot box truck, 34 crates, at $48 a crate, if it's cigarettes, and maybe a few cases of booze you're looking at. Maybe 5,000 gross, and 1,500 clams in your pocket after everybody's paid, including Golvino, who runs these docks, which, if your father knew you were still working for him, he'd probably marmalade you. He'd be shook, that's for sure.
Elefante blanched. The old guy had balls and smarts, and maybe a point. So you can add figures, he said. Where's this thing that you can't name?
I just named it for you. It's in a storage box, probably.
Elefante ignored that. He hadn't heard any name of anything. Instead, he asked, You got a slip?
A what?
A receipt, a storage slip, showing the box is yours.
The Irishman frowned. Guido Elefante didn't give receipts. His word was good enough.
He was silent as Elefante took that in. Finally, Elefante spoke. I got 59 storage lockers, all padlocked by whoever rents them. Only the owners got the keys. The Irishman laughed.
Be a good lad. Maybe it's not in a storage box.
Where is it then? Buried in a lot someplace?
If you want to relax with your slippers, I'm not your man. It's got to be clean, son. Clean, as a bar of palm olive soap. Your papa would see to it.
What's that supposed to mean? Pull your socks up, lad. I just told you. Wherever it is, it's got to be clean. It might just be a bar of soap, or be in a bar of soap. That's how small it is. That'll keep it clean, I suppose, if you put it in a big bar of soap. It's about that size.
Mister, you come in here singing riddles. You say this junk, whatever it is, needs a truck ride to the airport, even though it's the size of a bar of soap, that it's got to be clean like soap, that it might even be soap. Do I look stupid enough to run around for a bar of soap?
You could buy $3 million worth of suds with it, give or take a few dollars, if it's in good shape,
the Irishman said.
Elefante watched the worker closest to him lug a crate from the door of the boxcar to the waiting truck outside. He watched him shove the crate into the truck without saying a word or changing his expression, and decided the man hadn't overheard.
I'd let you talk pretty to me like that all night if I could, he said, but I'd hate myself in the morning. I'll get one of my guys to take you back to the Bronx. The subway ain't what it used to be. I'll do that.
for my papa's sake.
Sturgis held up an old, wrinkled hand.
I'm not having you on. I got no muscle to move this thing. I know somebody who might want to buy it in Europe. That's why I want to get it to Kennedy. But now, talking to you, you're a smart laddie. I think it's better if you take it. Sell it if you want. Give me a small piece, if you can. If you don't, that's okay. I got nothing except a lass at home. I don't want no trouble for her. She runs my business good. I just don't want to waste the thing, is all.
What is it, Governor? Coins, jewels, gold? What's worth that much?
The Irishman stood up.
It's worth a lot of crisps, he said.
Crisps?
Chips, money, dollars. Guido said he'd keep it, so I know it's been kept. Where, I don't know. But your pop never went back on his word.
He dropped his card on the elephant's desk.
Come see me in the Bronx. We'll talk about it. I can even tell you what to do with it. You can throw me a bone afterward if you want.
What if I don't know where it is?
For 3 million biscuits, you'll know.
For that kind of money, old man, anything but murder is a parlor trick. A guy can stop paying taxes for good chasing that kind of money around,
Elefante said.
I ain't paid taxes in years,
the old man said.
Come on up the street level, would you? How do I know you're square? What am I looking for?
Check your load. See what you got.
How do I know you're not a bartender somebody floated out here just to mix drinks and box me in?
You think I'm some tosser who came all the way out here at this hour for exercise?
The governor rose and stepped to the open back door, leaning on the door edge, looking out onto the dock, where two of Elefante's men could be seen several yards away, struggling to lift a huge, heavy box into the truck. He nodded at them.
You'd have ended up just like them if your father was like the rest of the gobshites we knew in prison, following the five families around.
The thing is called the Venus, by the way. The Venus of Willendorf. She's in God's hands. That's what your papa said to me, in a letter.
Elefante glanced at his father's old file cabinet, tucked in a corner of the boxcar. He'd been through it a dozen times. There was nothing in it.
Pop didn't write letters, he replied.
But the old man had already stepped out the door, slipped into the dark, empty lot across the street, and was gone. Chapter 6. Bunch. From the dirty window of a worn second-floor brownstone apartment, the great lights of Manhattan's skyscrapers danced in the far distance. Inside the dark parlor, a tall, slim brown man, wearing a colorful African kente kufi cap and dashiki, held a copy of the Amsterdam News newspaper in his hands and roared with delight. Bunch Moon was 31, head of Moon Rental Cars and Moon Steak and Go, and co-director of the Bedford-Stuyvesant Development Corporation, and was seated at a polished dining room table, grinning as he held the latest edition of the city's major black newspaper and read the good news before him. His laughter eased into a smile as he turned the page and finished the story he was reading. He folded the paper, fingered his goatee, then spoke softly to the 20-year-old man seated across the table from him, who was scratching at a crossword puzzle.
Earl, Queens is burning, brother. The Jews are burning it up.
Earl Morris, Bunch's right-hand man, was clad in a leather jacket, the features of his smooth brown face etched in concentration as he worked his crossword. He had a pencil in his right hand and a lit cigarette in his left. He was having trouble negotiating both while trying to fill in the puzzle squares. Finally, he placed his cigarette in the ashtray and said without looking up,
"Dig that."
"The city wants to build a housing project in Forest Hills," Moon said. "Them Jews out there are pissed, bro.
Dig that.
So Mayor Lindsay goes out there and they give him hell. He gets mad and calls them fat Jewish broads.
Bunch chuckled.
In front of the press and everything. Captain Marvel, you gotta love this guy.
Dig that.
Guess how many ran with it in their newspapers?
Not one.
Not the Times, not the Post, nobody. Just the Amsterdam News. He goes out there and insults the Jews and nobody says a drop about it. Except us. The Jews hate us, man. They don't want no projects.